Today I'm going to talk about cultivating joy on the Bodhisattva path. And I chose this because, partly because we've been studying this at Hokyoji for about a month now. And I just returned last week from Hokyoji's winter practice period, 3-week winter practice period, where we were really diving into this material. So it's not that I'm so much more joyful than any of you. I'm sure that there are many of you who are more joyful than I am, but that doesn't matter because it's just my own exploration of this that's making me want to bring it to you. So I also chose this because we've been experiencing a year of some pretty tough times with the pandemic, anxiety about that, and changed circumstances in our lives or our finances, political upheaval. So you might be thinking, well, joy shmoy at about this point. we may have the tendency to think of joy as trivial, like happiness, but it's actually a necessity for dealing with suffering in our lives and in the world. It balances out the experience of suffering, so we can continue to respond with kindness and care. And it isn't a denial of sorrow or a contrivance, but it's a way of seeing and being that softens what's difficult in life. So today I'll talk about what joy is, obstructions to joy, about integrity, contentment, and gratitude as building blocks of joy, and noticing and cultivating joy in the midst of all times. So a quiet joy is not the same as happiness or a good mood. It's a direction of the heart and mind, a gentle gladness in the midst of everything. Moments of joy come mostly unbidden in the case of a beautiful sunset, the birth of a baby or other peak experiences in life, in the unplanned encounter with a wild animal, or the dew on the grass in a meadow, a sunrise in the mountains. Experiences of beauty that are either distant or close to home strike us with joy and with gratitude to have been there to experience them. So it's often in these fleeting moments of nature that we experience this quiet joy. Music has the power to make us joyful, as does poetry or seeing a beautiful painting. Singing brings me joy. There's a lot we receive every day from our lives that bring joy, and it's often subtle. It's a matter of noticing what's already there and considering what we might be ignoring. That's important. How often do we simply not notice and savor the joyful moments that are right under our feet? Cultivating joy is based on the practices of mindfulness and meditation, the quality of attention that we cultivate in those practices. So this gladness that's spoken of in cultivating joy is inwardly directed, is born of stillness and awareness, and is inwardly generated too. It's the ability to be empathetic and intimate with all things, and it's dependent on understanding and uprooting the patterns that obstruct and stifle it. So life does bring lots of joyful moments, but if we're closed and contracted, those moments can't touch us. Cultivating stillness in this context is really important then, because the still mind and heart are the source of joy. And in the words of Dogen from Fukan Zazengi, the Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. Sitting practice helps us slow down enough to notice the sights and sounds that we might overlook after our sitting. Meditation lifts the veil on our senses that makes us not notice the shining nature of people and things. So today I'll talk about what joy is, the obstructions to it, and about integrity, contentment, and gratitude. A quiet joy. Oh, whoops. Already got to, went through that one. Where am I? Okay. Renunciation can bring joy. When I don't give myself whatever I want when I want it, it strengthens my resolve, and there's some joy in being able to do that. Some freedom from compulsion and obsession. The longing for joy is a universal longing that's at the root of all the life quests we commit ourselves to. It doesn't just cheer us up, it brings meaning and intimacy to our lives. And it's in the moments of joy that we feel ourselves to be fully alive, vibrant and appreciative human beings. There's also an inner taste of freedom and liberation to joy. We long to recapture joyful moments. It can feel like happy accidents that fade too quickly, and we can become relentless in pursuing or regaining the memory of those experiences. In that case, something wonderful is turned into an object of craving. And using craving to solve craving doesn't work. Pursuing distractions and sensual experiences just increase distress. Pursuing spiritual experiences because we've had one and want more doesn't work. Doesn't work. Christina Feldman says this about joy, not as an object of craving or a happy accident, but as a practice of awakening. In the path of awakening joy, like loving kindness and compassion, it is not left to chance. The seed of joy lives in each of our hearts. It's a potential and capacity of the human mind. We learn to cultivate joy, to understand the roots of joy, to sense what it is in us that obstructs it, and even with practice to abide in joy under all the circumstances of our lives. In the teachings of the immeasurables that are liberative, joy is not referred to as a transient, episodic state, but as a way of seeing, a way of being, and an embodiment of understanding available to all. We've been using the wonderful book at Hope Yoji by Christina Feldman called Boundless Heart. Tim and I co-led a practice period a couple years ago using that book, and it's a wonderful book. So, but in our emotional lives, we usually polarize states, the welcome and the unwelcome, the desirable and the undesirable, and the worthy and the unworthy. So the Zen teaching of not picking and choosing, it's an antidote to this common way of perceiving our reality. When we actually look closely at our feelings and perceptions, say at a retreat where we have the time and the space to devote to that, we see the conditioning that arises around what we like and want more of and what we don't like and want to push away. And to see it brings insight and choice. We have the choice. Our tendency to welcome and pursue the pleasant and avoid the unpleasant is normal, but it's a recipe for a frustrated life. We think that if sadness and depression are present, joy must be absent. And if joy is present, all unhappiness and anxiety will be gone. But to cultivate joy as a way of being in the midst of all the events and conditions of life is to transform our understanding of what it is. So we experience it not as a state of mind, but as a place to rest in our heart, beyond the dualities of our conditioning. Sometimes joy and sorrow are very close. This may be a dramatic example, but let me tell the story of when my father was in home hospice. Obviously, he knew he was in the last stages of his life. He'd become unhappy and lonely before his cancer diagnosis. My mother was in the nursing home, so he was living alone. He was a very gregarious person who liked to have people around him. He was often alone, and didn't call his children because he didn't want to bother us. In spite of that, he felt neglected. And one time when he was in hospice, a music therapist came while I was there, and she played some Scandinavian songs for him. My father has a Swedish heritage. And she told us that it was a song that was probably played to a young child on their parents' lap. Afterward, my father spontaneously spoke in Swedish. And that's a language that he hadn't spoken since he was 6 years old. And he didn't remember it, supposedly. So she asked him what it was, and he said it was a meal blessing. And tears just streamed down his face. I felt really fortunate to be there and to experience that joy of his and feel joy in that. So contentment. Contentment's one of the cornerstones of joy. Though circumstances and the conditions of our lives don't have to be perfect to experience it. It's the art of resting within what is. In Zen, we would say, as it is-ness. It's not some bovine thing, as Christina would say, just placidly chewing our cud in the meadow without a care, completely oblivious to others' suffering or happiness. Nor is it the absence of the hard and challenging, but the absence of our resistance and our argument with the hard and challenging. Contentment helps us live in the world as it is, without rejection or judgment. It doesn't mean that we're apathetic or don't take action toward improving conditions that are harsh or unjust for others. Taking action on behalf of others can come from creative discontentment. When contentment is grounded in us, imperfections embraced without triggering craving and aversion. I've heard one definition for contentment that I like. Complete cooperation with the unavoidable. Complete cooperation with the unavoidable. Contentment is the mind that's a friend, a place of refuge and confidence. The central teaching of contentment is radical. It's no longer agreeing to the world of conditions. Outer conditions don't hold the key to our happiness or lack of in this tradition. So the difficult neighbor with the loud leaf blower doesn't have the power to make us unhappy. The ideal vacation does not hold the key to our happiness. Contentment and joy are an inside job. When we know this, our friend can go on vacation in the winter to the beach, and we stay home cleaning out the basement. We can feel happy for their opportunity to go and reap some satisfaction that we're here doing what's necessary. Contentment teaches that we are the gatekeepers of our own hearts and minds, and any peace we find there. Contentment is not weakness, but strength. We learn to live in the changing conditions of the world with some grace. There's joy in seeing how our reactive patterns that are obvious to us when we begin to practice Zazen loosen over time. There's joy in seeing the calming and falling away of aversion and clinging. There's joy in discovering that we're just a little less judgmental. Confidence in the path we're walking brings joy. Aspiration and intention brings joy. And to know that every moment of kindness and compassion we can manage brings joy. I'd like to just pause for a moment and see if we can do a little guided practice on contentment. So get into a comfortable position. Take some moments to become still. Allowing your body and mind to settle into the moment, into the self. Sense the life of your body the places of ease and the places of tension. Listen to the life of your mind with its waves of thoughts and images. Notice the tone of the thoughts, those that are lovely or those that are neutral, and those that are flavored with discontent. Now bring a question into this quiet. What in this moment is lacking? What is being asked of me for contentment to be present? Thank you for doing that little practice. Let's move on to appreciation. Another foundation of joy is in cultivating the capacity for appreciation. We have a negative bias in our mind that we're countering with appreciation. From the perspective of evolutionary science, we're hardwired to perceive what is threatening, imperfect, or broken. The purpose of this was to ensure our survival, but we no longer need that for our survival. The Buddhist psychologist, Rick Hansen, says that the mind is, to the mind, the negative is Velcro and the positive is Teflon. So we have to work around that. We have to put in the time and the effort to cultivate the opposite of that. So we notice the weeds in the garden when they come up. We tell our partner all about the difficult parts of our day when we come home. We think a lot about the people that irritate us, at times more than the people we love. In meditation, we're focused on aching knees or intrusive thoughts. So cultivating joy is an invitation to reverse that pattern, that wiring in us. Mindfulness allows us to reclaim the appreciation, the capacity for appreciation. We can learn to cultivate moments of appreciation by stepping out of our busyness in the day, in the middle of the day, and our stories, and really see what's in front of us. In meditation, we sit and we care for what's difficult in our bodies and our thoughts, and we learn to give equal attention to all that's well and whole. We begin to notice the times in our day when we're not preoccupied with restlessness or craving. We can remember that we're healthy and not in pain. What a blessing. We bring our attention to walking, eating, and noticing the breeze in our hair. And we sense the ease and joy in those moments. And rather than glossing over the small acts of kindness we perform for others, and the words of encouragement that we extend to others, we learn to honor and celebrate those moments. And that makes room for joy. Joy is concerned with the capacity for seeing anew, seeing freshly. When we're feeling jaded and desensitized, the world becomes flat and gray. The sensitivity and mindfulness that we cultivate perceives value and worth in almost everything. It doesn't rely on drama and excitement to feel alive, but instead draws on receptivity and wholeheartedness. There's a powerful link between joy, mindfulness, and perception. Perception, distorted, organizes the world emotionally into friends and enemies, what we want and don't want. Then, caught by our habits, we rarely see anything freshly, and the wonder drains out of our lives. The past is again and again superimposed on the present. people become fixed in our minds, seen through the images and the memories we impose on them. Mindfulness teaches us to weaken the link between perception and the underlying judgments and tendencies that arise in us. We can apply this to ourselves. The thought of myself is not myself. And then extend that out to others. My thought of you is not you. Thich Nhat Hanh teaches this simple questioning technique to use whenever judgment or criticism arise, just simply saying to ourselves, are you sure? Are you sure? Wonders found in not knowing, rarely in familiarity. In long-term relationships, it's a challenge to remember that this other person we live with is a mystery. They're not our fixed view of them. It can be fun to get creative about ways to keep the don't know mind in our intimate relationships. The next building block I'll talk about is integrity. Integrity is as fundamental to cultivating joy as it is to all of Buddhist practice. Buddha described integrity as thoughts, words, and actions rooted in kindness and compassion. An ethical life is based on awareness of the roots of our thoughts, words, and actions, and whether they contribute to well-being or to distress. We live with the awareness of how others' thoughts, words, and actions affect us, and of how ours ripple out and affect others. We know that our safety, peace, and happiness aren't separate from that of all beings. We don't secede from the union of our interconnectedness. Integrity, as Buddha put it, is the joy of blamelessness. Blamelessness, to live without regret or shame, where no one fears us. And all religious traditions contain teachings on morality and ethics. People around the world pledge to live in a way every day that protects others and themselves, regardless of whether they're religious or not. The precepts are also gifts to ourselves that are protective of others and ourselves. The precepts are central to our practice of Zen and fundamental to cultivating joy. Generosity and gratitude. There is joy in generosity and gratitude. The capacity to give is a form of richness for us. It's a joy to be able to share our money, our time, and our encouragement with others. The 12-step program has a service component that's built right into it, as service and generosity is fundamental to the program of recovery. It chips away at the habits of self-centeredness that are destructive to the spirit. I have a friend who volunteers in a program that provides meals to 1,100 people in the Twin Cities. And he recently told me that he feels a great deal of satisfaction when he goes there to pack food boxes with all the other volunteers. The staff are so grateful and constantly let them know that. And they lavish it on to the volunteers, their gratitude. And he feels truly joyful to be involved in that work. It's often the high point of his week. Spiritual traditions have lots of ways of expressing gratitude for what's given, particularly in verses and gathas. And I brought you an excerpt from a meal verse I like that was written by our friend, Norman Fisher, originally for the Zen Hospice Project. As we make ready to eat this food, we remember with gratitude the many people, tools, animals and plants, air and water, sky and earth, turned in the wheel of living and dying, whose joyful exertion provide our sustenance this day. I'll just read that one more time. As we make ready to eat this food, we remember with gratitude the many people, tools, animals, and plants, air and water, sky and earth, turned in the wheel of living and dying, whose joyful exertion provide our sustenance this day. That's only half of the meal gata. You can find it if you Google Norman Fisher and meal verse. And you can print it out and use it if you like. It's helpful for me to stop in the middle of the day as many times as I can remember and reflect on the fact that my life is the gift of many. And that life itself is a gift, something that's easy to overlook. We've all had many helpers and benefactors to support us. Our parents, teachers, friends, and even strangers have helped us in so many ways. We would not be here without them. This isn't sentimental, but it's making a choice to live within either resentment or gratitude. We're grateful to others, and we can learn to offer gratitude for ourselves, for choosing to be here, for choosing to be awake and aware, for the efforts we make toward our own well-being and the well-being of others. We can even reflect on how the really difficult people and events in our lives have helped us to take the next step on our paths. In the Tibetan tradition, the difficult person is considered to be our greatest teacher. It isn't always so easy to see it that way in the moments of difficulty with them, but we can have the aspiration to see it that way. We can learn to be grateful for all these things. Joy is not so far away. And finally, mudita is the empathetic or appreciative joy that celebrates the happiness and good fortune of the people in our lives. When we're free of envy, resentment, covetousness, and discontent, we can begin to get a taste for the generosity that can rejoice in another's happiness and good fortune. This one seems to be hard for people, but it's a decision to practice it, and it's more than possible. It's like a muscle that we exercise. We start with easy things like delighting in children's laughter at play or the lover's kiss, and gradually we work our way up to being happy for things our friends are able to do and have, or the lovely spiritual qualities that they possess, regardless of whether we also have those qualities. We know what it's like to feel gladness with another and for another. I feel it's so easy and effortless for me to feel joy at my little granddaughter's new achievements every week. That's an easy one. It doesn't rely on dramatic moments, but it's a kind of just a little quiet celebration of life. There's a verse that Sri Lankan nuns have used when out on alms rounds that expresses some of this. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue. Although these lines might sound sentimental, they express something important to the cultivation of mudita. The phrase suggests that no one has to earn merit or be worthy of appreciation. It's enough that we're a living, breathing human being. Appreciative joy is not just for others, but equally for ourselves. My Dharma sister Kyoku at Hokyoji has these lines attached to the door of her living space, so she sees them whenever she leaves her space. How wonderful I am in my being. I delight I'm here. I take joy in my good fortune. May my happiness continue. How would it feel like to extend those lines to yourself? You might recoil at first. You might think it's self-centered or that you're not good enough. You might feel embarrassed or cringe. You might turn away from appreciation offered to yourself. That was my first reaction. The Buddha said, in speaking about love and kindness, that we could search the whole world over, never find anyone more deserving of kindness than ourselves. I think this is also true of appreciative joy. We wake up every morning and we decide where to put our attention, in resentment or appreciation, in generosity or withholding, in joy or in bitterness. The choice is up to us. We can learn that a peaceful coexistence between the hard and the easy, between sadness and gladness, is possible. We can learn to attend with compassion and kindness to the different hardships that come into each of our lives. Appreciative joy invites us to widen the circle of our awareness and the circle of beings to which we can extend it to. We can be touched by the small moments of wellness and happiness in our days. We can find joy in the happiness of others and appreciation for all the ways our lives interconnect with each other. Appreciative or sympathetic joy doesn't come from a great heroic effort, but of learning moment to moment how to direct our minds and hearts to empathy, gladness, appreciation, and to being awake. I'd like to end today with a Rumi poem. Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened. Don't open up the door to the study and start reading. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. I'll just read it one more time. Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened. Don't open up the door to the study and start reading. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. As always, Rumi is beautiful, but looks right at the heart of things. Of course, we don't always wake up frightened, do we? So that's what I have to say for what I brought for you today.